Happy Tuesday, and welcome to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And as I've been saying over the last few weeks, I haven't just started paying attention to or getting more curious about spirituality, but I have, for some reason, felt like I wanted to set aside this summer for more kind of internal, deeper searching experiences. And I'm not even sure what I mean by that, because it's not like I'm going on a vision quest or I felt like I needed to go on a retreat for an extended period of time, although I'd like a short one. It's not like I have a specific spirituality or religious teaching that I'm curious about. It's really non-specific. I just know that over the course of the last few years, I don't know if because I finally had the time to think about it more, but I've found myself kind of in this seeker mode. And I'm always curious. I think my curious mode is always in play. But the seeker piece of me, I guess, wanting to do a little deeper dive into things that have to do with religion and spirituality or my sense of myself as an individual. Because for those of you who are parents, you can appreciate this, that once you have kids, it tends to put a lot of your own personal work on the back burner because you're really focused on, or at least I was, on the mom job, on the family job, on the raising children job. And because my girls are 10 years apart, I've been doing that mom business for a really long time and really didn't feel like I had time to think about anything else really fully. I mean, I had time to do my jobs and be with my husband, you know, the fun stuff, hang out with friends, but kind of that personal stepping aside, not needing to be on call as a mom, really in the last couple of years. You know, my youngest graduated from college. She's has a job. She's self-sufficient. My other daughter is busy with her own family now. Yeah, I became a grandma in the last 3.5 years, and that was really busy. And in this moment, in the summer of 2019, I feel like all of that noise, important noise, life noise, kind of got in a groove and this opening appeared probably, you know, mid-March when I started looking at the summer. And this opening appeared and I felt like, okay, this is the theme of the summer. There's going to be some more seeking, always traveling, love getting in the car and taking off for the summer road trips and interviewing people. Definitely have that on the plan. But interspersed with some of these trips or within the trip or just even in the car while I'm tripping along, I wanted to bring more meaningful conversations to myself and with my husband and what I'm reading and what I'm paying attention to. So the long story short of this kind of seeker mind that is kind of pushing my summer agenda along was a revisiting of conversations I've had over the last few years. And, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we talked to Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffitt, professor at Cal Poly, a religious studies professor, about his journey and his understanding of spirituality. And that was a good kind of dip into the ocean. And he actually stayed and we did a second hour, which I'll be sharing with you later on this summer. But then after that conversation, I went back through my archives and I looked over a conversation I had with Matthew Fox, who is a world-renowned theologian and the creator of creation spirituality. And to be honest, when I had this conversation with him originally, probably 4 years ago, I knew nothing of him or his work. And as I listened back to the conversation, I realized how little I knew. And I'm sad that I wasn't more aware of who he was and the work that he had done, because I think I could have asked better questions. But maybe that's just the world of the interviewer, that we're always wondering if we could have asked better questions. I know as a therapist, you know, a good part of our job is asking questions. So I always hope that I do it well. But I wish I had another hour with him to go more deeply. But listening back on that conversation, I realized things that I'd missed that stood out a second time and actually have given some structure to what I'm looking for in my travels this summer. And for me, when I listen back in these conversations and want to, you know, revisit some things, I hear things that were said in a different light. Same words, but just they hit me in a different way because of the mood that I'm in or the state that I'm in or, you know, what I'm interested in at that moment. So I have pulled Matthew Fox's conversation back up. I listened through, I did some editing, added a little music to it, and I am happy with how it turned out. And although we won't be taking calls today, you can still be a part of this conversation by visiting our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. You can leave messages there, private messages, or post on our wall. You can see pictures of my travels or upcoming shows. You can follow us on Instagram, Elizabeth_TRT. We also be posting news about the show, and we'll be following my travels over the summer and posting to Instagram. You can listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org, or you can podcast the shows by going to Apple Podcasts, look for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, hit subscribe, and then the shows will be uploaded to your device. And if you have some time, you can leave a review, which also helps to grow the show, and I appreciate that. And you can always send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. So as always, thank you for being a part of our community, and thank you for supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We move now into my conversation with Matthew Fox.
When I begin to crumble,
interesting to me that, you know, when you learn a new word or you get curious about something, then all of a sudden that curiosity opens doors in so many different areas. And it seems like looking back over the show for the last 6 months or so, you know, there's been this kind of subtle theme that's come up a lot with the guests that we've had and the conversations that we've had about reawakening the feminine and looking for balance in the psyche and between masculine and feminine energies. I'm very excited to have Dr. Matthew Fox on the program today to talk about a spirituality for the 21st century, but also to talk about his work over the last 34 plus years in bringing creation spirituality and awareness to the world and bringing awareness of ancient mystics and the work of Meister Eckhart and Hildegard, and her work from the 12th century, her efforts to speak out for women and the divine feminine. All of these things are coming full circle, and Dr. Fox is with us today. Welcome, Dr. Fox.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Good to be with you.
I'm very excited. And as always, we meet every week here on this program to talk about those things that go on through our lives and our community and try to join us together in conversation. Dr. Fox, if you're not familiar with his work, is an internationally acclaimed theologian who was a member of the Dominican Order for 34 years before being silenced by then Cardinal Ratzinger and eventually expelled for challenging traditional doctrines and teaching creation spirituality. Dr. Fox eventually found a home in the Episcopalian Diocese of Northern California, where he's been a priest since 1993. Dr. Fox has authored over 30 books exploring many topics, including the need for a spirituality that grows out of our rootedness in nature, as well as the need for justice, compassion, and a reawakening of the sacred feminine and divine masculine. Dr. Fox has been called the most challenging theologian in America. Dr. Fox, I guess to start from me, who doesn't have a lot of background, tell us about creation spirituality, because that seems to be kind of the center stone of your work.
Indeed, it is. Most people are familiar with the tradition in the West of original sin and the fall and redemption model of Christianity. But the truth is that original sin is not a Jewish concept, therefore Jesus never heard of it. It was first used in the 4th century, which is also the century that the church inherited the empire. So I write about original blessing, and that is a Jewish concept. And in fact, this Christian spiritual tradition is the oldest tradition in the Bible. The J source, first writer in Genesis, is creation centered, and so too are the wisdom books. And now the scholarship agrees that Jesus comes from the wisdom tradition of Israel, and the wisdom tradition is about finding God in all of nature, in all of creation, not just in a book. In fact, it's about how all of creation is a book about God, as Meister Eckhart says. So this tradition, since the 4th century, has not been that much heralded by church officials. But the truth is that Hildegard of Bingen, Francis of Assisi, Thomas Aquinas, Meister Eckhart, Julian of Norwich, Mechthilde Magdeburg, all great medieval mystics were very much in this tradition. And so I've been trying to recover that, and there's been some opposition along the way. But this is a tradition that is feminist. Wisdom in the Bible, as well as around the world, is feminine. And it's a tradition that honors artists and creativity, and it honors science, because science tells us about nature. Thomas Aquinas said, a mistake about nature results in a mistake about God. So obviously you have to go to those who study nature, and that would be scientists. A good example of that in today's world would be the whole issue of homosexuality. It's a scientific issue. It's the Galileo case of our time. Science has spoken. 8 to 10% of a given human population anywhere on the planet is going to be gay or lesbian. And we've counted 464 other species that are gay or lesbian, that have gay and lesbian populations. So it's not unnatural, except to a heterosexual. It's not unnatural to a homosexual. So it's a minority, but it's real. And so that's just one example of paying attention to science instead of wrapping ourselves in old codices with theological slogans covering us up. So this tradition is also prophetic. The wisdom tradition of Israel really grew up after the prophetic tradition had kind of run out of steam. And the Bible says wisdom is a friend of the prophets. So that means that justice and compassion play a very important role in this tradition, too. So you can see why it upset a few Vatican apple carts. Mm-hmm. I tried to bring this tradition alive, and I've written 3 books on Hildegard, who, by the way, was declared a saint a year or two ago, and a doctor of the church. And there are only 3 other women who have been declared a doctor of the church. And it's really quite ironic. Now, it's very ironic that Pope Ratzinger, who didn't have an ounce of feminist awareness in his body or mind, that he actually declared this woman a saint and doctor of the church is really quite amusing. And, in fact, my recent book on her, the last chapter is called Is Hildegard a Trojan Horse in the Vatican? Because the big thrust of her theology is to bring the divine feminine alive. And I don't think Ratzinger had a clue about what he was doing in declaring her a saint, that he was letting this Vatican, or this Trojan horse of the divine feminine right in the middle of the Vatican. It's really very amusing.
So where did things shift? Because it sounds like in the 12th century there was a feminist movement or an awareness at that time, and that there was even a movement towards balance and a reverence for nature and the natural world. What happened between the 12th century and now that we lost that path and we had this rising of the patriarchal religious culture? And
Well, you're absolutely right that the Middle Ages was a real breakthrough. And the 12th century, which is when Hildegard lived, is also the time when the goddess returned to the West for the first time, mm-hmm. and really the last time until our era. And so the goddess and the green man rode in on the goddess's coattails represents the creativity imminent in all of creation. And the green man represents the defense of Mother Earth, the warrior defending Mother Earth. And the green man was very prominent, too, at this time. In fact, Hildegard says Christ is a green man. And at Chartres Cathedral, you know, in 125 years, there were 500 churches built in the Middle Ages, in Europe, all dedicated to Mary, and Mary is the goddess. And Sarkozy Cathedral is one of those, and they're like, I think, 170 images of the Divine Feminine of Mary in that cathedral, but there are 42 green men as well. So the green man also rode in, so that men changed their consciousness at that time, as well as women. And, of course, the movement to Gothic architecture, utterly Romanesque, very squat and thick-walled and little window architecture that had dominated for centuries, this was a great opening of the soul. And as Adorant says, you want to know the soul of a culture, you go to its architecture first. Mm-hmm. So the Gothic architecture, as you all know, let light in. And, of course, the stained glass window revolution of the 12th century was really comparable, I think, to the electronic and digital revolution of our time. And it opened the soul up to see so much beauty coming in and lit up by the sunlight and the rich colors. So there really was a rediscovery of nature and science. And, of course, Aristotle came in at the end of the century, and Aristotle represented the best science of the time, and he was just being translated then into Latin, into the European language, and that was by way of Islam. So this is what Thomas Aquinas picked up on. He was absolutely ecstatic about the new science of that day, namely Aristotle. He wrote 10 books on Aristotle, not a single book on Plato or Augustine, and he said why. He said, Aristotle, unlike Plato, does not denigrate matter. So in many ways, Aquinas was feminist insofar as he insisted on the non-dualism of spirit and matter. Augustine had said, and I quote, spirit is whatever is not matter, unquote, which is utterly dualistic. Aquinas said, no, spirit is the elan, the vitality in everything that includes a blade of grass or a horse or anything else. So it is very non-dualistic, and that was a real battle in the Middle Ages, and in many ways, Aquinas lost because he was condemned 3 times after he died. Then later they made him a saint. But Eckhart came out of that tradition with Aquinas, and of course, Francis of Assisi, who was not really the intellectual that these others were, nevertheless was the practitioner. And, of course, everyone knows that he was very Celtic in his spirituality. He found the divine in animals and plants and in all our relations. So, and that's clear in his poem to Brother Sun and Sister Moon, for example. And in that poem, there's this marvelous balance between the masculine and feminine. Every sentence goes from the masculine to the feminine and back again. It just shows a very, very balanced psyche on the part of Francis of Assisi.
If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, joined in the studio today by my guest, Dr. Matthew Fox, a world-renowned theologian and author, to talk about how the modern age developed knowledge, but at the expense of wisdom. The result has been ecological disaster, destitution for the indigenous peoples everywhere, loneliness, and a loss of meaning and shared values in our lives. Religions have too often promoted an exclusivism, which has ripped the human family apart and separated us from what unites us. Dr. Fox says we need a spirituality which brings wisdom back to our relationship with nature, to our work, to our educational systems, to all our relations, one that speaks to the aching hearts of the younger generation. So Dr. Fox, if I'm hearing you, you know, this period of time, almost a golden era in the 12th century, there was all of these intellectuals and these writings and this work towards balance and the reverence of nature, and then it disappeared, and now there seems to be this recalling, this desire, this unconscious aching around the planet to have this revived. And so I'm curious what your piece in this is. What is it that you envision at this moment in time needs to happen globally and spiritually to bring healing?
Well, one thing that happened in the Middle Ages was there was a very grassroots movement of women called the Beguine movement. And I write about this in my recent book of Meister Eckhart because he was very involved. And the Beguines were lower class women. They were not highly educated, but they chose not to live as nuns or as married people, as wives. So it was a third option that the culture was not offering at the time. So they lived in small communities together, and they earned their living often as craftspeople, and they served the young and the poor and the sick, and they also read scriptures and other works in the vernacular, and they did have their training, if you will. They studied together and so forth, and they brought in people like Meister Eckhart, Dominicans and Franciscans, who would instruct them. But the Pope, John the 22nd, condemned them not once, not twice, but 17 different times, which is quite amazing. It shows that his condemnation was not sticking. And when that Pope died, and he's the same Pope who condemned Meister Eckhart a week after he died, that Pope, what can I say, threatened, very threatened. The patriarchy was very threatened by these women who were not married and were not part of a monastic community. So I think that parallels today's women's movement and women getting together in circles to tell their stories and to empower each other. But I think also today we need a men's movement for sure. So a couple of years ago I wrote a book called The Hidden Spirituality of Men, 10 Metaphors to Awaken the Sacred Masculine, because even if the goddess returns, and she certainly has been returning the last 40 years, still, the goddess deserves a worthy consort, and I think that we're all saddled today with a toxic masculinity. Mm-hmm. I think that our versions of masculinity come very close to being synonyms for the reptilian brain. Mm-hmm. It's about winning. It's about being number one. It's about triumphing and conquering, and I think we've been treating the earth this way, and we've been treating other nations and cultures this way, and then you have these crackpot things happening, whether it's ISIS or the dangers of NFL football players beating their girlfriends and their wives and all the rest. So you have a lot of reptilian brain testosterone energy out of whack today, and it gets headlines. And by that I mean it's kind of the not-so-subtle value system of a culture. So this has to be addressed, and the way I address it in my book is I take 10 metaphors of the sacred masculine. What would be healthy masculinity? Mm-hmm. So a metaphor like the green man, or Father Sky, or the blue man, or the hunter-gatherer, or the spiritual warrior, or fatherhood and grandfatherhood, the elder. All these are archetypes that can stir us up and help us to recover the sacred masculine. And the very first response I had to that book was from a woman. She emailed me and she said, I have over 200 books in my library, personal library, on the goddess, not a single book on the sacred masculine. And until I read your book, she said, I didn't realize how much men have suffered under patriarchy. Mm-hmm. And she said, I have two teenage sons. So you're right. We really have to examine this. This is the next step of the feminist movement. But she said, I don't regret the last 40 years of wrestling with my own womanhood to find the divine feminine. But now I think you're right. We have to embrace the masculine as well. And I got a response from a Native American who worked in prisons for 12 years. And he said, working in men's prisons, the hard thing is that they don't want to do their introspective work. They don't want to look inside. They love to project on others. For years, he said, I looked for a book that would get men to look inside, and I found it in your book. I got them, with your book, to look inside and find the nobility that is in there, on the inside. And I think that's a beautiful phrase, the nobility on the inside. That's what men are looking for, but they're not being encouraged to do it in a way that's efficacious and that works. And, of course, it's not just men who need a sacred masculine. Women, too, are walking around with a toxic masculinity in their souls if we don't clean it up, you see. Just as men have a goddess inside, women have the sacred masculine inside too, provided we can detox it.
So I guess my question is because as a Episcopal priest, you would be associated, I would think, with kind of an organized religious foundation. And do you believe that we need to be part of an organized religion to find that wholeness and spirituality? Do you believe that the spirituality for the 21st century is going to be found within organized religious groups? Or is this spirituality that you talk about as each individual being whole into themselves, being a prophet, being a mystic, something that can be discovered outside of the confines of a religious order?
No, I think that the spiritual can be found both inside certain communities and outside. A lot of people, especially younger generation, are not even looking anymore into institutional religion for their spirituality. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean they're not looking for spirituality. So I think we're at a place where a lot of organized religion is kind of running out of steam. As I say, we need to travel today not with basilicas on our back, but backpacks. We need much lighter and more portable spiritual practices. But at the same time, there's a lot of wisdom within the traditions as well. So it's not an either-or. And some people feel called to stay within organized religion, some to be without, some with one foot in and one foot out. I don't think that's really the issue today. I think the issue is finding ways to calm the reptilian brain. Mm. Essentially, that's what meditation does. Mm-hmm. Also to awaken all the chakras so we can be fully engaged in living and in preserving life. That's the mystical and the prophetic side. Of course, the role of ritual and ceremony is very important. This is why 65,000 people go to the desert in Burning Man every August, because they're that hungry for ritual that awakens them. So what I've been doing since I've been an Episcopal priest is what we call the Cosmic Mass, which is we bring rave into liturgy, essentially. So it's about dancing our prayers and not just reading them out of a book or being read to, and it's bringing in the postmodern art forms of DJ and VJ and rap and so forth to make a very lively, celebrative experience that gets all the chakras alive again. So I think that's what's important, is our moving from couch potato-itis to aliveness. And that, to me, is what spirituality is. It's about being more fully alive.
Build me up from bones, wrap me up in skin, hold me close enough to breathe me in.
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett with my guest, Dr. Matthew Fox. And we're talking about creation spirituality and the need for awakening a new spirituality for the 21st century, balancing of the masculine and the feminine, reawakening the divine feminine and the sacred masculine. And how do we do this to help heal the damaged ecosystem in the world and the damaged psyches of those on our planet? So, Dr. Fox, I'm trying to get this picture of what, you know, the spirituality of the modern era looks like, because I teach at the local university and I work with young people all the time, and I also am, as a therapist, do a lot of work in mental health. And so my concern is this disconnect that people feel not only from each other but from themselves and from the natural world, and with the growing use of technology numbing us. And like you said, there are clearly people craving this connection to the spiritual through Burning Man and other rituals. How do you envision spirituality for the next generation? How will they practice, and how will we find them and engage them when it feels like they are pulling further and further away?
Well, we have to re-sacralize nature and our relationship to nature, and that is done primarily through the new cosmology, the new creation story from science, that we're 13.8 billion years old and that the universe is hundreds of billions of galaxies and growing, that there's a star being born every 15 seconds. All this is awesome, and it fills you with the sense of the grandeur and the sublimity, the sublimeness of our of our world, and it's a privilege to be here. So we have to begin with creation stories. That's how all our tribes, indigenous tribes, and certainly the Bible, which begins with not one but two creation stories that contradict each other, in fact, this is how it begins. So to realize where we come from, and it's not just, we don't come from Silicon Valley, we don't come from Safeway, we have to reconnect to the growing processes of the soil and the seas and the seasons. We have to reconnect with our relationship to four-legged ones and to the trees and the finned ones and the soil and the forest. And so it is a matter of rediscovering. But I think today's science helps us a lot. Mm-hmm. Rediscovering the unique situation we're in as human beings, that we're very, very late on the scene, and yet a lot has happened to make our presence possible. And then we've done a lot with it in terms of our creativity and all the rest, but of course we're also capable of great destruction and what should I say, evil. Aquinas says one human being can do more evil than all the other species put together. And that was 800 years before Stalin or Hitler or Pol Pot. So our creativity is amazing, and our intellects as well. But, of course, they can be used for good or ill, and we have to be more and more alert to how we're misusing our capacities. That's why there is so much climate change and ecological destruction. And we can't allow ourselves to wallow in denial. I was in Florida a couple of weeks ago, and the governor of Florida, who lives in northern Florida, put out a decree saying that henceforth no government agency in the state could use the phrase climate change in any document that they put out. He's in complete denial about climate change. He's saying, what, me worry? Meanwhile, in Miami, and I was in Miami, in the southern part of Miami, there are 6 inches of water on the sidewalks. Mm-hmm. So Florida is already going under, and you have a governor of Florida in complete denial. And we have to cut through denial. My striker says God is the denial of denial. In other words, as long as denial reigns, there's no divine energy flowing whatsoever. It's all a lie. So we have to wake up. We have to get out of our couches, and we have to speak up and make a difference and use our immense creativity for healing the earth, which we're very capable of. I mean, in India, they've invented a car that runs on air, compressed air. Well, that makes sense. Air is still relatively cheap and available. And, of course, this kind of car gives no carbon dioxide and no global warming comes out of the rear end. So what we're capable of is immense, but we have to start living our values. And if we say we love our children and grandchildren and potential great-great-grandchildren, well, we better start leaving a healthy planet for them, or we're just liars.
Well, and I think that's going to be my conversation center point always, is that I think that the awareness and the need and the desire for conscious change is out there. And I think the struggle is, how do we bring all of these great thinkers together, all these great ideas together, and energize the planet? Because it feels to me, just sitting in this chair and talking to different thought leaders in our culture, that there is a lot of brilliance, but not a lot of areas or vehicles for bringing that brilliance together. And I worry for our younger generation, because they seem to be moving further away as the elders are saying, but wait, we can make change.
The essence of a healthy religion and spirituality, does that have something to offer? And indeed it does, because meditation teaches us to calm the reptilian brain. That's what meditation does, I think. Once you calm the reptilian brain, then your mammal brain, which is half as old as a reptilian brain, can assert itself. And it's a mammal brain that is about kinship and compassion and relationship. And that's really what has to thrive at this time. This is where I think all the spiritual teachers of the world, from the Buddha to Lao Tzu to Jesus to Isaiah to Muhammad too, and the indigenous teachers too, were teaching about compassion. They put their focus on the mammal brain. The word for compassion comes from the word for womb in both Hebrew and Arabic. And, of course, it is the womb people, the mammals, who have this sense of kinship and compassion. So I think that's where the focus should be. And as I said earlier, whether it's in religion or out of religion isn't that important. The Dalai Lama has said, we can do away with all religion, but we can't do away with compassion. Compassion is my religion, he says. Well, Luke 6 has Jesus saying something similar when he says, be you compassionate as your Creator in heaven is compassionate. But I don't think we should be tripped up by the ugliness and the stupidity of some of these religions that are getting so much press today and are anti-science and anti-intellectual and anti-evolution and are just new incarnations of reptilian energy, and whose goal is to, to triumph over other religions. I think we're beyond that as a species. I hope we are.
Well, and I think that part of the conversation, and I keep going back to this, is if we have so many people around the world having this consciousness, this awareness that things have to change, that we need to move away from kind of this toxic masculinity and find this balance. And it's not, and I hate the conversation to be confused with talking about toxic males, because it's not about men versus women. It's about an energy, a masculine energy that's toxic, as opposed to a feminine. And our feminine energy tends to be more about the community and caregiving and nurturing. And that masculine energy, when whole, is also about nurturing and caregiving, but it also is the warrior and the doer that is essential in a balanced society.
Yes.
And so how, there's a couple other points that I wanted to touch on, because you talk about the, in creation spirituality, the four paths to wholeness, the four paths of spirituality as they relate to the world. And I wonder if we can touch on those four, because I think there's so many people that are searching to be a part of something greater than themselves, and maybe they have been turned from organized religion. And so when I was reading about your four paths of spirituality, the positivas, that really resonated with me. And I was hoping you could talk about the four of them for other people who have this growing desire to feel spiritually engaged but feel disconnected from a greater organized tradition.
Sure. I talk about intergenerational wisdom today. I did a book a couple of years ago called Occupy Spirituality, which is about young adults. I did it with Adam Bucko, who's a 30-something, who works with street youth and street young adults in New York City. And we did surveys, national surveys, of young adults and their attitudes towards spirituality and so forth, and their practices. And one of the questions we asked was about their relationship to elders, and 98% said they want relationship with elders, but they can't find them. Mm-hmm. And then the few they do find, they said talk too much. But I think that's a very important thing, that we need a new burst of communication between the elders and the young adults. That's why it's an intergenerational wisdom today. No generation has all the answers. So I think we have to really promulgate that. Now, regarding the four paths, yes, these are archetypal, really, of ways to understand, I think, our spiritual experiences. So the first is the via positiva, which is the experience of joy and of awe and wonder, what Rabbi Heschel called radical amazement. And it results in gratitude. And I think that's really the opening and the bottom line in spirituality of a healthy kind, is that it's about gratitude. And Thomas Aquinas taught that in the 13th century. He said the essence of religion is the virtue of gratitude, not buildings, not bishops, not dogma, but gratitude. And that's something that gets stirred up in our hearts.
Can
the
we
second path.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can we find that positiva in nature? Also, you talk about awe and quaking.
Of course. Of course. That's where most people find it. Bill Everson, the California poet, used to say, he said, most people find God in nature or find God not at all. So absolutely, nature is the primary source. That's why earlier I talked about a new creation story. Of this fills you with gratitude to realize how special it is to be here after a 13.8 billion year journey. And there aren't that many of us around. It seems crowded on the planet Earth, but in terms of the size of the universe, we're very minuscule, and it's a privilege to be here. Okay. So the Via Negativa comes next, and that's about silence. We touched on that earlier, too, I think, that the silence is a gateway to the heart. This is why all meditation practices teach us the value of being still and of solitude, and that's how you calm the reptilian brain. Because reptiles, check it out, reptiles aren't good at bonding, but they're good at lying alone in the sun. And that means they're monks, because that's what a monk is. Monos in Latin means solitude, being alone. So you want to entertain that capacity for solitude. But also, the Via Negativa is about letting go, and it is about suffering and grief. And we're all in grief today about the ecological collapse of our amazing planet and the rest. So, and a lot of reasons to grieve. So we want to pay more attention to the grieving dimension of life. Without that, we do not heal. And we're not energized if we're stuck in our grief and not dealing with it. So that's another thing I've been doing a lot of, is developing practices for grieving. We always include that in part of our cosmic mass, too, as part of our cosmic mass, because people are very hungry to grieve today, and the churches are doing a lousy job, and the synagogue, too, of leading us into practices that really get the grief out.
I think part of the problem, though, with the Via Negativa is that we are in a culture also that everything's about happiness and being happy, and we should never feel sad, and that there's this thing, anti-darkness, that people want to avoid it, and so they become numb to it. And I think that's why the depression and anxiety levels are so epidemic, and the use of medications, right? But if we don't allow ourselves to explore the dark and the depth, we can never know the light. Am I following you?
And that's what the mystics teach. The dark night of the soul is a school at which we learn very important things. And I think, frankly, that we're in the dark night of our species today, because there's no one on the planet who knows what the outcome is going to be in terms of the sustainability of our species. Currently, we're on a very, very suicidal path, and we're bringing many other species down with us. So clearly, the direction we're in generates anxiety and fear and even apocalyptic imagery. Mm-hmm. So we've got to learn to let go, and that's where the Via Creativa comes in, the next path, because creativity is the one thing our species has going for us. And like I alluded earlier to the invention of a car that runs on air, there are so many things we could be doing differently. And we have to give birth to whole new forms of education, of religion and worship, of politics, of economics, for sure. We need an economics that works for everyone. Mm-hmm. And that's all the beings on the planet, not just every two-legged one. Wall Street does not cut the mustard. That works for 1%. It's not working even for 99% of Americans, much less for other species and for other people around the world. So we need a new economic system. Are we capable of it? Of course we are. We're very creative beings. But we have to focus and get it done. So, and then the last path, Via Transformativa, it emerges out of the creativity. It's a path of justice and compassion and healing and celebration. And each of these paths is a way into healing. But it culminates in path four, if you will, the Via Transformativa, because we can be transformative agents to displace injustice with real justice. And you look at the need for eco-justice, gender justice, economic justice, social justice, racial justice. All these things are demanding our attention today. And to deal with them effectively, we all need a spiritual life. We need an inner life that acknowledges each of these four profound experiences along the way. Via Positiva, Negativa, Creativa, and the Transformativa.
And I think you also talked about this not being a vertical path either, that it's a spiral path.
Exactly, exactly. And it's not done once and for all. Once you get some justice flowing, then you're back to via positiva, because justice is not an end in itself. It's a means to bring more people to the table so they can enjoy life in its most basic form. So that's the via positiva. So then by bringing more to the table, there's more celebration, there's more joy, and everything goes on another path. So my symbol for this is an open-ended spiral. It keeps unfolding and keeps expanding.
This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett with my guest, Dr. Matthew Fox. We're talking about creation spirituality and becoming transformative agents for wholeness, and this idea of a new spirituality for the 21st century. How do we awaken all of our hearts, all of our chakras, all of our energies? How do we awaken the planet? What do you think, Dr. Fox, about the need for the transcendent experience?
Well, I think that the transcendent experience is found in the imminent. And this is, for me, is what the tradition of incarnation means, that the divinity takes root within matter, within flesh, within history, within time. And I think there can be too much emphasis on leaving the physical behind. I think that tends to create too much dualism. So I think that if you look hard enough, there's extraordinary in the ordinary. And there's love in the blood, sweat, and tears of the struggle for justice, for example. And so I think there's a danger in isolating the transcendent, as if we have to leave our bodies and so forth to experience that. Now, it is true that we have experiences of angels, for example. I wrote a book with Rupert Sheldrick, the British biologist, called The Physics of Angels, that this just come out recently in a new edition. And angels, of course, are agents of consciousness, and they're beings of consciousness that are essentially not physical. And we do have these experiences, especially within our intuition and in dreams and so forth. So we do participate in a world bigger than the physical world or the visible world. We participate in both visible and invisible worlds. But I don't agree that the access to the invisible world has to force us to leave the visible world. I think that the invisible world is seeking to communicate with us on a regular basis through the physical. Was it that Baudelaire said in the 19th century, we walk through forests of physical things that are also spiritual things that look on us with affectionate looks. So I think that the spiritual is very present in the physical. It's present in all our relations, as the Lakota people pray. And you have spiritual experiences with animals, with trees, with rocks, with the soil, with our ancestors, and with angels and other beings as well. But I think that we don't have to overemphasize the transcendent. We just have to recognize that it arrives even in this world of immanence and of flesh and blood.
And I think you talk about needing to subtract from the material to really find that wholeness inside.
Well, materialism is one thing, and I couldn't agree more that we have to resist the materialism of our culture, which denies consciousness in, or sometimes some people deny it altogether, and then others deny it in every being except humans. But that's materialism. But I'm talking about matter. We don't have to escape matter. Matter is sacred. It is holy. What did David Bohm, the physicist, say? Matter is frozen light. Mm-hmm. So it's light moving very, very slowly. And I did a study on all the world's spiritual traditions called One River, Many Wells, and in one of the chapters is on light. And what I found is that light is the most often used synonym around the world for the divine. So to say that matter is frozen light is another way of talking about the divine that's present in all matter as well as in all light. So again, I think there's a danger, especially from the influence of Plato and Augustine and other dualists in the West, but certainly also from the East. There's a danger of denigrating matter, as if we have to leave matter to experience the spiritual. And I quoted Aquinas earlier, you don't have to do that. The spiritual is what's most alive in matter. And Teilhard de Chardin, the Jesuit scientist and poet and mystic, he wrote about that, how the matter itself contains the divine presence. And we just have to learn how to look at it differently. And we have to let go of the mythologies, which, again, are very patriarchal mythologies that tell us that matter is an obstacle to the spirit. It's not. Matter awakens the spirit. And but materialism is another thing. That is an ideology that says that our souls can be satisfied by consumerism. Or in the traditional word, gluttony. Mm-hmm. And that's just not true. And yet our whole economic system essentially runs on that. And so we find ourselves embraced by an ideology of materialism that is destructive. And it makes us lonely and out of touch, as you said earlier, Elizabeth, with ourself and with nature and with others. And so we become cosmically lonely. But the key is to rediscover, as I said earlier, the sacredness of matter and all our relations.
Well, and it's something that you mentioned as you were just speaking about one river, many wells. And I'd love you to touch on that a bit as it associates to spirituality connected to this idea.
Well, I take that language from Meister Eckhart, who says, God is a great underground river that no one can dam up and no one can stop. So I say, okay, divinity is an underground river, but there are many wells into the river. There's a Taoist well and a Buddhist well and a Hindu well and a Sufi well and a Christian and a Jewish well, indigenous well, and so forth. And but they all go to the same river. And what humans have tended to do is to stay at the top of the well, at the surface, and to go to war with each other around my well is better than your well. Well, the truth is we've got to make the journey down, whichever well we choose to go down or combination thereof, and get to the river. And at the river, it's all one well. There's one wisdom flowing underneath. So that's my little story or image of talking about what I call deep ecumenism, about how at the deep level of spiritual interaction and practice, including practice for social justice, there's only one river, and we travel different wells, or at least we should. Like I say, the temptation is just to stay above the well, to stay at the surface, mm-hmm. and where organized religion preens itself. But no, we have to take journeys into our deeper selves and into the deeper realms of our various traditions, where the mystics and the prophets and the warriors have done their work. And that's why today I think there's a much greater interest in spirituality and mysticism than there is in organized religion as such, because this is really the depths of religion, and this is what really matters. As I said earlier, the structures of religion, and including the doctrines, these tend to be at the surface, and they may be able to serve some good uses, but the essence of religion is something much more internal than that, and that's what we mean by spirituality, becoming more fully alive. That's an internal thing.
Well, and I love this visual, and I want to stay with that as we close up the show, is that you're talking about all of us needing to journey through the well, whichever vessel we choose to go through, whichever well, whether it's organized religion or individual spirituality or through a nature-based spirituality, to go deeper into the well, into that. And I think as you were talking about via negativo, that stillness, that dark place, that silence, to be with that long enough to experience the river, the flow, the oneness of with all. Am I right? Am I on the right?
Yeah, no, definitely. As the Psalms say, be still and learn that I am God. Mm-hmm. That stillness is a requisite, really, and that's what meditation does for us. And it calms our reptilian brain so we can be still. And then we can hear what's really going on in a deep place. And as you say, then we can choose the paths that work for us. Now, a lot of people today in this postmodern time are mixing their paths, and that's okay, too. Mixing is part of postmodernism. So, like myself, I'm a Christian, but I derive tremendous help from the Native American traditions, whether it's sweat lodges or vision quests or Sundances. I was at a Sundance a few months ago, powwows. There are just many practices in the Native American tradition that are very profound and that mean a lot to me personally in terms of the journey that I take. But I don't have to give up my understanding of the Christ story or the Jesus story to profit from the Native American practices. And obviously there are other practices from Buddhism and Sufism and other traditions that can be very valuable too. So that's one of the gifts of living at this time, that we're being given a smorgasbord of practices from many traditions, and this should not confuse us. It should bless us and make us deeper people.
You've been listening to my conversation with Matthew Fox, world-renowned theologian, and I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. And although we didn't have the phone lines open today, I encourage you to be part of the conversation by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, or joining us on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or following us on Instagram, Elizabeth_TRT. And as always, you can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org or podcast the show by visiting Apple Podcasts or however you download podcasts. Hit subscribe and the show will be uploaded to your device. Thank you for supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Thank you for supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.